Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, there's a rap against Hillary Rodham Clinton, that she's cold, robotic. That was certainly not the persona she presented on her visit to Seattle this week. If Clinton were a robot, she'd be the Rock'em Sock'em variety, with a healthy dash of reflective and forward-thinking feminist, doting grandmother, and super-sharp political analyst.
After they get their tax bill, you know, which they have been yearning for. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine, like, waking up in the morning and saying, today? Yeah. Today, I'm going to give the Koch brothers everything they've ever wanted.
Ms. Clinton was on the road with her new book, What Happened? The work is a reflection on her failed run for president and how she is recovering from the loss. Clinton was, of course, the first female presidential candidate in the United States to be nominated by a major party. Here, former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton addresses a sold-out, raucous crowd at the Paramount Theater, then chats with author Anne Lamott about a wide variety of political and social issues, and finally, the question of hope. The Seattle Theater Group presented Hillary Clinton live on December 11th, thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You can find the full event on our website, KUOW.org/speakersforum.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here tonight. I love Seattle. My mother, Nikki Lamott, Dorothy Nora Wiles Lamott, and I shared a love of Hillary Clinton going back to, I don't even know how far back. And then in 2000, she got ill, and she'd had Alzheimer's for a while, and she had to go into memory care, and so I'd see her almost every day, and every day she'd say, any news on the woman who said yes? And it took me, and for about 3 days, I just played along with it, and I'd say, all systems go, Mom. And then on about the fourth day, I realized that she was talking about Hillary Clinton, who had agreed to run for the New York senatorial seat. And then every single day for several months, any news on the woman who said yes? And there always was, and there always will be. And so, please join me in welcoming the woman who said yes. I'm so happy to be here with all of you. It's always great to be back in Seattle, and I'm especially looking forward to talking with Annie Lamott, who I have been a fan of for many years. So I'm really excited about this conversation. Thank you. And you know, I just want to make a few brief remarks before Annie and I start talking with each other about my book, What Happened, because
As I write in the book, in the past, I've often felt like I had to be careful in public to keep my guard up. Well, those days are over. What I've tried to do is to pull the curtain back on one of the wildest elections in American history and to talk about moments that still frustrate me, including in a chapter called Those Damn Emails, but also a lot of the moments that I want to remember forever, like the way it felt standing on that stage in Philadelphia and becoming the first woman to accept a major party's nomination for president. And I am still proud of the campaign we ran and the 65.8 million Americans who supported it. And of course, I am so honored and delighted to have won this city and this state. I have to say, though, that you know, writing this book was often a painful process. Ultimately, it was cathartic. It was even reinvigorating. And so these days, when people say to me, well, how are you? I say, well, as a person, I'm okay. As an American, I'm really concerned. And this book is about the future as much as the past, and I really hope that there are lessons in it that apply to everyone as well as to our country, and I just want briefly to touch on four. First, everyone gets knocked down. What matters is whether you get back up and keep going. And, you know, in those days and weeks after the election, I would be asked all the time, how did you even get out of bed? And I'll admit, there were times when I was tempted just to pull the covers over my head. But instead, I spent time with friends and family, especially my two grandchildren. I read a lot, especially mysteries, because the bad guy gets it in the end. And I watched a lot of HGTV. I went into a frenzy of organizing my closets. I played with my dogs, I did some yoga, including alternate nostril breathing. And yes, I did have my fair share of Chardonnay. So I also talk in the book about what my faith meant to me and how important it was in some of those very dark hours and days to have that to fall back on. And Annie and I will talk about that as well. I started a new organization called Onward Together to encourage the outpouring of grassroots activism and engagement. We're seeing it now across the country because really there is too much at stake for anybody to sit on the sidelines. And people have to keep speaking out about issues that matter in your lives and in the lives of people you know. You know, it's been more than 2 months now since Congress let the Children's Health Insurance Program expire. I came from Denver today where I did a book signing at the Tattered Cover bookstore, and three people who went through that line told me what CHIP had meant to them and to their family. And it would just be such a disgrace if we allow 9 million kids and their families to lose the security of health care. And of course, as we speak, the Republicans are trying to jam through a so-called tax plan that manages to bust open the deficit without strengthening our economy. It is nothing but a giveaway to the wealthiest among us. It comes at the expense of everyone else. So, whether it's health care for kids and families or tax changes that benefit those at the very top,
These are issues that people have to be engaged in and speaking out about. And I really think we can turn the tide if enough of us stay focused and don't lose heart about trying to beat back the mean-spiritedness that we see coming out of Washington. Now, the second lesson I want briefly to mention is this. The only way we will get sexism out of politics is to get more women into politics. Washington State is one of the places that has proven this. Your two women senators, your former woman governor. It really does matter, and I'm thrilled that more and more women, particularly young women, are thinking about getting involved in politics. And I would just say this, as I write in the book, this is not just about politics, even though my chapter is called On Being a Woman in Politics. This is about business. It's about journalism, academia, whatever walk of life you're a part of. And the research is pretty clear. You know, for men, likability and professional success go hand in hand. In other words, the more successful a man becomes, the more people like him. With women, it's the exact opposite. The more professionally successful we are, the less people like us. And maybe some of you in this room have had that experience. And there's another piece of it, because it's all under the rubric of ambition, you know, which is fine for men, not so good for women. Women are seen favorably when we advocate for others, but unfavorably when we advocate for ourselves. And that really struck a chord with me, because historically, people like me when I'm serving in a supporting role. When I'm serving as First Lady in the White House, or serving the people of New York in the Senate, or serving as a member of President Obama's cabinet. But the minute a woman, or in this case me, stands up and says, now I'd like the chance to lead, oh my goodness, everything changes. And I can't think of a single woman who doesn't have stories to tell. So yes, there are plenty of reasons why being a woman in politics can be frustrating and even infuriating. But it can also be deeply rewarding. Just by being at the table, you're bringing a perspective that might otherwise go overlooked. And really, one of the best examples of this was last spring, when we all saw pictures of groups of elderly white men getting together to make decisions about the health care that women need. Remember those pictures? And that kind of continues, and it's something that you know, we just have to be speaking out against. I've been inspired by the women and girls that I've met across the country over the last 2.5 months. They're stepping up to lead. I love it when little girls come to my book signings and they're wearing pantsuits and Wonder Woman costumes. And more than 22,000 women have signed up for candidate training programs. And I want to give a big shout out to groups like Emily's List and Emerge America and Run for Something. So I hope women of all ages will read this book and be inspired to get involved. And not everybody will run for office, although I hope many will. But to be part of campaigns, to be active citizens, to be engaged, getting into the arena, we need you now more than ever. The third lesson is this. The forces at work in the 2016 election are still with us. It was a perfect storm, deep currents of anger and resentment flowing through our culture, a political press that told voters my emails were the most important story, the unprecedented intervention in the election by the FBI, and the information warfare waged from within the Kremlin. Now, what we've learned about Russian interference in the election is more than alarming. It is a clear and present danger to Western democracy, and it is right out of Putin's playbook. You know, know, that's why I wrote a whole chapter about it, because when I was writing the book, there were still many people who were saying, oh, come on, it wasn't that big a deal, you know, we don't know what happened, it's so confusing. So I tried to write a chapter which was up to date as of the time I turned in the manuscript, you know, last July. But here's what we know. We know that Russian agents used Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, even Pinterest, for goodness sakes, to place targeted attack ads and negative stories. Now, they were intended not only to hurt me, but to fan the flames of division within our society. Russians posed as Americans, pretending to be gun rights and Black Lives Matter activists to stir people up. They even held phony demonstrations. And what's more, the propaganda was aimed directly at so-called undecided voters, soft Clinton supporters who might be persuaded to back a third-party candidate or not vote at all. But this isn't just about what happened back in 2016. It's about what's happening right now. The Russians are still playing on anything and everything they can to turn Americans against each other. This is bigger than one candidate, one election, even one country. And that's why we should be doing everything we can to confront this urgent threat to our national security and our democracy. You know, every president swears an oath to faithfully execute the law and defend our Constitution. This president should do his job. And the rest of us have to keep up the pressure and demand that we get to the bottom of what happened to protect ourselves. No foreign power in history has attacked the United States with so few consequences, and that puts us all at risk. And it's not only the Russians who influenced the results of the election. You know, there's been talk about rigged elections. Well, there's no better example of an attempt to rig an election than the massive voter suppression we've seen across America. This is the civil rights issue of our time. Laws that make it harder to vote disproportionately hurt minorities, students, and the elderly. It's not a coincidence, it's the intended effect of those laws. The people behind them, Republican governors and secretaries of state and legislatures, they literally want to shrink the electorate so that they keep people out who they know will not vote for them and their values. And this issue has not gotten enough attention. These laws are a blast from the Jim Crow past. Not only do they undermine people's civil rights, they undermine everything we stand for as a country. And Americans of every political party and ideology should be outraged. And more than that, we've got to do everything we can to educate voters about their rights and to end these craven efforts to keep people from exercising those rights at the ballot box. Now, the fourth and final lesson is this. It's very close to my heart. There is no such thing as an alternative fact. As I try to explain in the book, the Russian disinformation campaign was successful in part because America's, our natural defenses had been worn down over years by powerful interests that wanted to make it harder to distinguish between fact and fiction. When leaders deny things we can see with our own eyes, like the size of a crowd at the inauguration, or when they refuse to accept settled science when it comes to urgent challenges like climate change, it's not just frustrating to all of us who pride ourselves on living in the fact-based universe. It is insidious and subversive to democracy. So where do we go from here? Well, I don't have all the answers. I wrote this book in part to lay out some of the questions, to provide my best understanding. But when it comes to Russia, we need to get serious about cybersecurity. We need to get tough with Putin. And we must insist on truth and accuracy and hold elected leaders and the press accountable when they fail to meet that standard. And we must refuse to be silent in the face of racism, sexism, or attempts to normalize bigotry. So let's have the courage to stand up for human rights and women's rights and gay rights and democracy. And most of all, we must vote in every single election, not just the presidential ones. So I am going to do everything I can going forward, not as a candidate, but as an active citizen. And I have to tell you, all the people who have said for months, go away, keep quiet. No. No, not for you and not for me. I'm not going anywhere except right into the middle of the debate about our future. So thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. I asked Huma, do you think I should call her Secretary Clinton or can I call her Hillary? She said, oh, I think you can call her Hillary.
Yeah, I think so too.
And then I said, can I call her Honey? And she said, maybe. So anyway, I love the chapter most on being a woman in politics. I love the book, and I love independent bookstores. And if you want to get a really good seat in heaven, buy books from independent bookstores. But I wonder if you could, for people that haven't read it or that are going to buy it tonight, I wonder if you could just talk more about that one chapter, the overview of on being a woman in politics.
You know, I realized when I was writing the book that the experiences that I had on being a woman in politics were not just unique to me, and I could, by describing some of what happened to me, make some larger points about what happens to women who put themselves forward into the political arena. And that became really clear to me, and I write about this, how during the campaign I'd see members of the press, particularly, you know, on TV, they'd interview somebody and the person would say, well, you know, sure, I'd vote for a woman, just not that woman. And I used to think, well, prove it. Which woman would you vote for? And then as soon as the election was over, the attention of all the naysayers and the, you know, sexists and misogynists who we have too many of, as we know, they began to go after other women in politics. So remember when Elizabeth Warren is standing on the floor of the Senate and she's reading a letter from Coretta Scott King during the debate about Jeff Sessions being nominated to be Attorney General. I was in the Senate for 8 years. I got to serve with both Patty and Maria. So I loved being in the Senate. And I don't remember anybody ever being thrown off the floor before, mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, there was Mitch McConnell telling her to cease and desist from mm-hmm. reading Coretta Scott King's letter mm-hmm. and finally ordering her off the floor. Now, what happened immediately after that? One of her colleagues, a really good guy, a great male senator, comes onto the floor gets the opportunity to speak, and he reads the letter from Coretta Scott King and nobody says anything. Mm-hmm. Or Kamala Harris, right? was questioning, again, Jeff Sessions, in the Intelligence Committee, as I recall, and you know, she was asking him tough questions. I remember that's perfectly appropriate. And she was told to stop. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing all these other attacks on women in the Senate and women predominantly, but not exclusively, women in the Democratic Party, because it's not exclusive. I remember, and I write about this, how Trump went after the only woman running in the Republican primary, remember? And then he went after women commentators and interviewers, and he created a permissibility mm-hmm. that we now see all over social media to go after women in ways that are, you know, really personal and vicious. So part of what you have to do if you want to be in politics or in the public arena is just be determined that you are going to take criticism seriously but not personally. And here's what I mean by that. You know, sometimes you do have to learn from your critics. They can give you insight that you might not otherwise have, or your friends might not see or share with you. So you can take something that someone says, okay, you know, maybe I can improve this, or maybe I should, you know, do that better. That's one thing. But when it's aimed at undermining you and attacking who you are and what you stand for, then don't take it personally. Because usually the reason that someone's going after you is they have another agenda. And so I try to explain in the book some of the strategies that I've used over the years to withstand, you know, a lot of incoming critical attacks from all over. But it has gotten more intense because of social media. And therefore, you just really have to be prepared if you go out there to have yourself ready to deal with those who are going to oppose you. And they will oppose you over anything, right? Mm-hmm. It does not matter what your hair looks like. They will figure out a way to criticize you for it. It does not matter what your voice sounds like. They will figure out a way to criticize. And they will use words and images that create this almost caricature. And the final thing I would say about this is, I write about her very briefly in the book. There's an incredible woman professor at Cambridge University in England who is one of the world's leading scholars on the classics. So she knows a lot about Greeks and Romans. And I got to meet her a few years ago. And she talked to me about how this effort to tell women to shut up and not speak goes all the way back to the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. It is part of the historical DNA that we carry with us and that many people still have somewhere lodged in their brain that, you know, women shouldn't talk too much, women shouldn't talk too loud. And therefore, we have to learn strategies about how to stand up for ourselves, speak for ourselves, but recognizing that a lot of people are coming from a really deep, ancient, you know, feeling about what's appropriate for women. So it's fascinating stuff, and I think we're making progress. And the best way we can deal with this, as I said earlier, is get more women on the stage, get more women speaking out, get more women standing up, and then it won't seem so unusual.
Thank you, honey. Are we now in a constitutional crisis?
Well, let me say this. I think there are reasons to be worried. A lot of the rhetoric and actions coming out of the administration have certainly been aimed at muzzling the press, at trying to affect the justice system, looking for ways to find loopholes that the rules, particularly around ethics, don't apply to people in the White House. So there have been many breaches, and I would argue ethical and legal breaches, but I wouldn't say that we're yet in a constitutional crisis, and I hope we don't get there. I hope that enough people, particularly in the Republican Party, will prevent that from happening. And here's what I mean by that. Look, the ongoing investigation into the behavior and actions of people connected with the Trump campaign and then the Trump administration have raised some really serious questions. And we have stopped, thankfully, we have stopped some of the worst things from happening. But it is incredibly troubling. And again, I say this should be troubling to Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, progressives, libertarians. I don't care what anybody calls him or herself. If you believe that the government of the United States should be led by people who put our country first, not promoting the interests of a foreign adversary over the interests of the United States, if you believe that people in the White House should not be using their positions to their own financial advantage and violating at least the ethical restraints that should be operational. And you can go down the line. This is a well-informed audience. You see what is going on. But I don't want to say we're yet there. And here's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that put aside the horrible policy, and I think this tax bill is horrible. It is horrible. It will explode the deficit and the debt. It will explode inequality. It takes all kinds of benefits and needs away from people and transfers wealth dramatically to the richest of the rich and multinational corporations, all of that. It's terrible policy. You know, maybe there's an outside chance that it can still be derailed, and it should be. But once that is through, then what do the Republicans in Congress have to worry about? They have to worry about getting reelected. That seems to be what they worry about, their donors, and they worry about getting reelected, basically. So if they have to start worrying about being reelected, they're going to wonder, is what's happening on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue good for me? Is it going to help me get reelected? Maybe I'd better speak out and stand up. And it was quite significant. I don't know what's going to happen in Alabama tomorrow. It's a lot closer, and it's a much more vigorous contest, thank goodness, than it ever could have thought to be. But when Senator Shelby, who's been representing Alabama first as a Democrat, then as a Republican, came out yesterday and said he would not vote for the Republican nominee, that was a significant action. So, look, I mean, I'm hoping that we will avoid a constitutional crisis because enough Republicans will put country over party and not let that happen.
Yeah. The whole world can hate America for its military might and its bullying and its extreme wealth and whatnot, but historically there's always been something really, really different about the State Department, and that this was where wars were stopped. And democracy, and I mean diplomacy and foreign ministries were always sacred. And you must have felt when you were Secretary of State that you were really on the side of the angels. And I guess my question is, it's so creepy. Trump's, I mean this nicely, There's just something so creepy and disgusting about Trump's systematic dismantling and conscious dismantling of state and how perfectly it complements Russia's interests.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could just talk about that. And also, is what Tillerson has already done to state irreparable, or is it not quite as dire as I think it is?
Well, you know, Annie, it's a really important question because, you know, I was so honored to be Secretary of State for those 4 years under President Obama, and I had such respect for the professionals, the Foreign Service officers, the civil servants, many of whom had deep expertise in language and culture and history that is so important when you're dealing with such a big, complex world like we have. So it's been disheartening and really troubling to see the way that first President Trump and the people around him in the White House discount diplomacy and kind of dismiss the hard work that diplomacy requires. But then to see Tillerson, who has a view that is so dangerous. It's not just creepy and disgusting, it's dangerous. And that is, let's get rid of the expertise that has been built up over decades. It takes a long time for someone to learn fluent Urdu or Pashto or Arabic or whatever it might be. And, you know, the exodus of those very people from the State Department is going to leave us without the resources that we need. We don't know necessarily when we will need them. That's why you have this apparatus in the first place, so that you're able to pull the levers and use the tools that can avoid a crisis or resolve a conflict or further one of our values. You know, the biggest loss to me right now is that, yes, we've had our challenges. I am certainly aware of those in our own country. But we always did try to stand for something bigger than ourselves and to be that beacon of freedom and hope and opportunity. I, for example, took on the task of trying to make as a central core of our foreign policy the advancement of women's rights and responsibilities because I believed it was the right thing to do, but I believed it was also in America's interests. And it was important that we stand up and be on the side of women struggling for economic and social and political and cultural rights. It's why I went to Geneva and said that, you know, gay rights are human rights and stood up for the rights of the LGBT community because I was calling leaders, begging them not to pass laws that would criminalize homosexuality to the extent that it could lead to the death penalty. I mean, that's what was going on. And we are still in this big, you know, ideological battle over, the fair and equal treatment of the LGBT community. So these were things that we stood up for because we believed that they were part of America's mission in the world. Now, we also conducted very tough diplomacy. I was the one who kind of laid the groundwork and began the negotiations to try to put a lid on Iran's nuclear program because I thought trying to prevent Iran from achieving a nuclear weapon while they're engaged in all kinds of other aggressive behavior was really in America's interest. So you can go and look at how you have to be, you know, dealing with the world as a whole and not just focused on one area and not just, you know, trying to provide economic advantages to American companies. So I'm very disturbed by the attitude that this White House has. I'm very disturbed by what Tillerson has done. Even when he tried to practice diplomacy, he was undercut by the president's tweets. Why are you trying to do diplomacy to end the threat from North Korea, you know, it'll never work, we'll take care of it. I mean, who says that? I mean, really, it's so distressing. And of course, it plays right into the hands of Kim Jong-un. I mean, he thinks he's died and gone to heaven because He gets to trade insults with the President of the United States. It's so counterproductive and dangerous. So I think that I don't think we've done irreparable harm, and I am somewhat heartened that even Republicans in the Senate are trying to prevent a lot of the worst cuts that Tillerson has proposed that would just decimate not just who's there now, but it shuts the pipeline for young people wanting to go into the Foreign Service. We saw a big surge of young people wanting to go into the Foreign Service when I was there and when Secretary Kerry was there. And now, you know, no, people don't want to, you know, they don't want to go in. They know they're not welcome. And so we're going to be, you know, hurting ourselves in the future. So it's a very threatening situation. And again, I hope that there are enough people who understand the costs that remain in the Senate on the Republican side to help prevent that over the next year.
But in the face of it seeming clear that Russia longs for America in chaos, and so that Trump is colluding with that, it seems to my tiny princess self, how do you keep yourself from conspiracy thinking? How do you keep yourself from thinking that there is a vast
right-wing conspiracy. Yeah. Well, I did think that, but I didn't know that Russia was involved in it. I know. What you said in the beginning is really important. And, you know, sometimes people will say to me, it's so confusing, all this Russia stuff. I can't keep track of the people. I don't know who did what. I don't know what it matters and all that. Well, here's what I want people to understand. I know Vladimir Putin. Part of the reason he so much wanted to elect the other guy is because I know Vladimir Putin. And I know that, you know, he really does, as Annie said, he really does want to undermine Western democracy. He wants to, and we saw it from the beginning, he wants to end NATO. He wants to disrupt and dismantle the European Union. He wants people to doubt democracy and to yearn for authoritarian leadership. He has become the symbol of white supremacy, and he has a real following now in the United States among people who, for whatever reason, feel compelled by this image of a dictator. Today, at my book signing, I told Annie this backstage. I really love the book signings, too, because people, even though it's not a lot of time, I try to give everybody a chance to say something and what's on their mind and what's bothering them. And so three generations came through, two little girls, their mom, and their grandmother. So I greeted the little girls and asked them their names, and I, you know, said hello to the mother, and then the grandmother said this to me. She said, "My father was in the SS." Which means he was in the Nazi military internal suppression force. He said, "So my father was in the SS," and she said, "That's why I thought it was so important to bring my granddaughters here with my daughter, because we can't let anything happen here. We have to keep speaking out." Now, you can say that's pretty extreme, you know? And I know people would say that, and I'm sure there's some people who would say, but this was this woman's own personal experience. She was telling me that as someone who had lived it, she was really concerned. And I think I've said often that Trump doesn't just like Putin, he wants to be like Putin. And part of what has been so frustrating to him, he wasn't all that acquainted with how government works and how cumbersome our system is. I mean, our founders actually made it kind of complicated so that we wouldn't have somebody ending up as a king or a dictator.
Right.
So for everybody who gets really frustrated by it, there's a reason why it's frustrating. And so, yeah, you keep pushing and pulling and trying to get things done, but you don't, you have a nation of laws, not a nation of a single leader. And I think he was very disappointed to discover that when he got elected. And so, look, I just believe that what Putin decided was to do what the Russians have done for decades, but increasingly in Europe, and that is to influence the political process. Now, as I write in the book, one of the few silver linings from what happened in November of 2016 is that once the Europeans saw what happened, they began to put the pieces together. Because remember, right after our election, there was a Dutch election, and the Russians were supporting the far-right anti-Muslim candidate, and he was defeated. Then you had the French election, and Le Pen had gone to Moscow to seek the support of Vladimir Putin. And the French were really smart, and Macron's campaign was really smart, because as soon as they caught on a lot quicker than a lot of we here in the United States did, because they're used to this. They're used to the Russians messing with their systems. So as soon as they saw what happened, they immediately knew, oh my gosh, they're going to come after us. And remember one of the very first revelations from Facebook. Facebook originally said, a lot of water under that dam by now, but originally they said, there were like 400 sites where the Russians were influencing us on Facebook, But there were 50,000 sites in France. Now, eventually, we all know that there were a lot more sites in the United States. It was one of the things we're finding out. But when the French realized that, Macron's campaign was so clever, we just didn't know it. I mean, we couldn't, we were like the first canaries in the coal mine. So what Macron did was to seed his email account with phony emails. And the French also have a law, which turned out to be really helpful in the French election, because WikiLeaks started dropping emails from Macron's campaign the Friday before the Sunday election. But the Americans who were conspiring with the Russians and the Russians themselves didn't know about this law, which puts a press blackout on campaign coverage for the final 72 hours. So a lot of protections were built into their system, and they were able to avoid it. The Germans also were much more aware, but the right wing in Germany got into the Bundestag. They got more votes than they'd gotten since World War II. So this is nowhere near over. And I will say, this is going to come back in 2018. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the Congress finally in the summertime passing very stringent sanctions on everybody who had anything to do with interfering in our elections. They passed those sanctions overwhelmingly in both the House and the Senate, not unanimously, but overwhelmingly. Trump was sort of forced into signing them because the pressure was so great. He has not enforced them. Tillerson disbanded the Office on Sanctions that we had in the State Department to enforce sanctions on North Korea and on Iran, and in this case, on Russia. This is not over. And, I don't care whether you're on the right, the left, or the center of our political spectrum in America, no American should want a foreign government conspiring with whoever they're conspiring with our country to undermine our elections. That absolutely must be stopped.
Well, let's accept, on another topic, let's accept that the GOP Congress will almost certainly not do anything about the 18 women who have accused Donald Trump of sexual abuse. Do you think that there's more that the congressional Democrats can do to bring pressure to bear on a self-proclaimed sexual predator? Yeah. I again mean that nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he did confess on the Hollywood Access tapes, right? You know.
He did.
Look, I think that unless some, I think some of the accusers have brought lawsuits that are working their way through the court. I think that the Republicans are being forced to have to respond, and some are finally saying, well, these women should have their chance to be heard. Mm-hmm. I think that Nikki Haley did that yesterday on the Sunday shows.
By accident.
But I want to go back to what I said earlier. If after they get their tax bill, you know, which they have been yearning for. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine like waking up in the morning and saying, today, today I'm going to give the Koch brothers everything they've ever wanted. And in order to do that, I'm going to take away the deduction the teachers had so that when they bought supplies for their classrooms, they could deduct it. I'm going to take away the extra medical cost deductions that people with really serious health problems have. I just find it impossible to understand this. And yet this is what they live for. So here's my hope. I mean, some of these, I don't know about in Washington state, but in other states, some of the Democratic or some of the Republican members of the House are on record saying, well, I have to be for it or my donors won't take my phone calls.
Right.
Honestly, you know, get a life. If the only people that you call are your donors, anyway, if they get this through, which I'm still hoping they won't, that's my hope. If they don't, I'm hoping that, you know, some of the Republicans in the Senate will stand up against them finally. But anyway, if they get it through, they really have nothing left to do. They don't care about anything else. I mean, I do hope they will reauthorize CHIP. I would like to see that done. And really, the only thing that they can do, which is really horrible, is to begin to cut back on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps and the safety net and all the rest of it. So we want to keep them busy with other things. And therefore, I think as they look at November of 2018, when all the House is up and a third of the Senate is up, they might say to themselves, you know, we've got to look at least like we care. And so on these issues, and maybe a few other issues, like the emoluments issue and things that are still out there, maybe they will be more willing to speak out. Now, I don't know that the leadership in either the House or the Senate would ever have hearings, which is why it's really important that we take back the House in 2018 as...
Thanks for streaming this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. And thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. You can find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.